Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Imagine living comfortably off stored body fat for days, losing your leg in an accident, but feeling no pain because you've been vaccinated against pain. Then growing your leg back, moving objects with your mind, using telepathy at your next staff meeting. It may sound like science fiction or a summer blockbuster, but these seeming miracles may well be reality soon. After changing much of the world, humans now appear on the brink of transforming themselves in radical ways. My guest tonight calls it radical evolution, turbocharged by high technology and certain to challenge our very understanding of what it means to be human. Tonight on Point, the coming high-tech makeover of the human race and what it may mean for humanity. You can join the conversation. Are you ready for technology-enhanced superhumans in our midst? Can you imagine a tech-driven successor, evolutionary successor, to humans as we know them, appearing in this century? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Joel Garrow. He's an editor and reporter at The Washington Post, a former senior fellow at George Mason University and the University of California at Berkeley, and an avid student of culture, values, and change. He's the best-selling author of Edge City. His new book is Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. Joel Garrow, great to have you. Thanks for being here tonight.
Good being here, Tom.
Wow, what a picture you're painting. You start right off, and maybe the place, because I just want to get a sense of what the heck you're talking about here. It is indeed radical. You describe, let me see, here's somebody who's got a girl who's in a second grade daughter. Mm-hmm. And you look into that daughter's future. A second grade daughter, I guess, today.
Right.
You look into that daughter's future after she graduates high school. She goes off to a wonderful college. She gets into an elite law school. Mm-hmm. And she comes home and she tells her parents about her classmates in that law school. This is 15 years out.
That's right.
And what does she see in those classmates, Joel Garrow?
Well, none of these are predictions. I'm a reporter. I'm just talking about what's in the lab right now. And if what's in the lab works, what you're seeing is your second grade daughter suddenly coming back from law school and dear old dad says, well, tell me about what it's like. And she pauses and tries to figure out how she's going to explain it. And she says, well, they're much brighter than anybody I ever met and even more bright than anybody I ever imagined. They have incredible memory. They just devour books in minutes. They're ripped physically. They're just beautiful.
But that is muscular.
That's right. They're just beautiful physically, and yet they don't put much of a premium on exercise. One of her friends fell down and opened up a gash on her leg, and your daughter freaked and expected to have to go race her to the emergency room. But this person just focused on her wound, and it suddenly stopped because she has the capacity to control her bleeding with her mind. These are the sorts of things that are in the lab right now, especially in organizations like the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency.
That's the Defense Department's research agency. And you go right on down the list. You describe that friend as having been vaccinated against pain. There's a challenging idea.
That should be an initial public offering pretty soon.
Seriously,
yes.
Literally.
Mm-hmm,
you vaccination. Talk about these new friends. And this imagined now second grader in an elite law school in 15 years, we should say, you describe her as what will be called a natural, that is unenhanced. So she mm-hmm. doesn't have any of these. I mean, she has what we know as a high-grade version of human behavior, but not these.
She's an original equipment human.
Original equipment. Her friends, you say, always are connected to each other, sharing their thoughts, no matter how far apart, with no apparent gear. They call it silent messaging. It seems like telepathy. You say they have an odd habit of cocking their heads in a certain way whenever they want to access information they don't have yet in their own skulls, as if waiting for delivery to arrive wirelessly, which it does. And for a week or more at a time, they don't sleep. They joke about getting rid of beds in their cramped dorm rooms because they use them so rarely. And you're saying all these things, the kind of
super intelligence, super memories and recall, super bodies, super healing capacity, super communications capacity without even speaking, super energy that allows them to go on without sleep, all these in the labs right now.
Well, yeah, there's at Duke, for example, they've got a telekinetic monkey, a monkey that can move objects with her thoughts. Do you want to know how you create a telekinetic monkey?
Yes, I do.
I'm so glad you asked. Well, what happens is the first thing you do is you take this really cute monkey named Belle, and you get her hooked on computer games. She's got a joystick, and if she can take the cursor and match a flashing light, she gets a drop of juice. But Belle's a real smart monkey, so after a while, she almost cares about the juice. She's hooked on the game.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as that happens, then you drill a hole in her head, and you take a device that's smaller than a penny that has hundreds of superfine wires on it, and you drop it into her motor cortex, which is that part of the brain that controls muscle motion.
Mm-hmm.
And you line up all of these little wires right next to individual neurons so that the wires can see the neurons as they flash.
Yes.
Then you seal her up, and you fire up the computer game again.
Now she's wirelessly attached to the computer game? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, she's got these individual wires that are right next to her neurons,
yes.
And these wires can in effect read her mind.
But what's that little penny doing? Is it then broadcasting her desire?
No, it's attached to a wire, which is then attached to a computer.
I see. Okay.
With the computer, you can watch the neurons as they fire, and you can see what's happening, and you can decode the neurons that are equivalent to a muscle motion.
So the joystick becomes irrelevant.
You unplug the joystick,
and she's actually playing the game simply with her mind.
Simply with her mind, she's moving the cursor. She's moving
the cursor. Telekinetics almost.
Well, yes, but that's not the cool part.
Mm.
Then what they do is they take the signal and they pipe it from Duke 600 miles north up to MIT into a lab here where there's a robotic arm. And there, as she plays the computer game, the robotic arm dances like a ballerina in exactly the fashion that her arm would be moving if she were moving her arm. So that's what I mean. She's moving physical objects long distance with her mind, aided by the computer. Now, the question is, why in the name of everything that's holy would you want to do something like this? Well, there's two answers to that. There's the official answer, which is that the Defense Department thinks that an F-22 jet fighter is a very difficult thing to fly with a joystick.
Mm-hmm.
And they think how much better it would be if you had a man-machine interface in which a human brain and the machine was increasingly becoming one, and you could fly the F-22 with your thoughts, and it could feed its sensors back directly into your brain in an increasingly one-on-one situation. That's the official answer.
And this is just one slice of a very, very big array, growing rapidly, of kind of supercharging technologies you see coming at humans. I want to talk about a lot of those technologies in the lab already and coming as you see it tonight, Joel Garrell. But give us your big picture here that you see this fitting into. What's the path that we're on in this century that leads you to say that we may develop a kind of evolutionary successor to you and I as we sit here this evening, old originals, original parts falling apart maybe, in this century? What's the path we're on?
Well, I think we're at an inflection point in history. For the last hundreds of thousands of years, all of our technologies have been aimed outward at modifying our environment in the fashion of fire, clothes, agriculture, cities, space travel, and so forth. Now, however, for the first time, our technologies are aimed inward at modifying our minds, our memories, our metabolisms, our personalities, and our kids. And the question is, at what point does this change what it means to be human? What's driving this is a curve of exponential change in technology unlike anything we human beings have ever seen before. Back in the 60s, there was a guy named Gordon Moore, who's one of the three founders of Intel, you know, Intel Inside. And he noticed that the number of transistors you could fit on a chip was doubling every 12 months.
Famously, Moore's Law.
Moore's Law. And he thought, and he famously predicted that maybe that might go on for 10 years. Well, it's now, we've had now had 29 doublings since the original chip. And we've never seen anything like that before in human history. The closest thing you can point to is something like the railroad in the 1800s. A doubling is an amazing thing. It means that every step that you take is as tall as all the previous steps put together. Well, the number of railroad miles in the 1800s doubled 14 times, and it changed everything in this country. New York went from being a collection of villages to a world capital. Chicago went from being a frontier outpost.
Now that scale of change, even much greater scale of change, applied to human beings specifically, directly.
We're up to 29 doublings since the 60s.
It happened with chips. Saying it's going to happen, that's somehow going to flow into the human being and transform the human being. How?
Well, what these new chips are doing is opening up vistas in entirely different areas that you don't even think of as being computer-driven. Things like genetics, robotics, and nanotechnology. Nanotechnology, by the way, is the science of creating things one atom at a time, one molecule at a time.
Tiny little machines.
Tiny little machines, nanobots, millions of which could flow through your bloodstream. Well, when you're doing that, you know, with genetics alone, you're creating pharmaceutical advances such that in the next 3 to 5 years, you should see memory pills on the market. And the original reason for that is to help people with Alzheimer's. But in no time at all, this is clearly going to come out to people, we boomers, with our senior moments.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I think this is going to be a much bigger deal than Viagra. And then it's going to move out to education. Because what part of education isn't affected by memory?
And you're saying in 15 or 20 years, you're going to have people enhanced in so many dimensions that they begin to appear as if they are a successor species.
One of the scenarios is that you might end up with more than one kind of human being walking the earth. You might end up with the enhanced, the naturals, and the rest.
It's been a long time since that happened.
It's been 25,000 years if you think that you have to go back to the Cro-Magnons to see a different kind of species, and 50,000 years if you think you have to go back to the Neanderthals.
Joe Garrow, stand by. We have to take a short break here. There's a lot more we want to hear. We're talking tonight about the coming high-tech makeover of the human race and what it may mean for humanity, for humanness. My guest is Joe Garrow. He's author of the new book, It Is Radical Evolution. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you ready for technology-enhanced superhumans in our midst? Can you imagine an evolutionary successor to humans as we know them appearing in this century? And does onrushing technology make a species upgrade inevitable? Or does this sound like fantasy to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the coming high-tech makeover of the human race. My guest is Joel Garrow. He's author of the new book, Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. You can join the conversation tonight when the neighbor's kids are jumping higher, thinking faster, and have total recall. Will you sign your kids up for some radical evolution? And with Viagra, Botox, and pumped-up super athletes, are we already on our way? Can you see the species dividing in two, the enhanced and the rest, in this century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You've got some great quotes in the book. You quote here Katharine Hepburn in John Huston's The African Queen saying, "Nature, Mr. Allnut, is what we are put in this world to rise above." You describe that happening rapidly and happening now. I wish you'd describe for a moment to us some of the work that's going on in the Defense Department research labs, the kind of super soldier they're looking to create, which you say is in no small part what's cracking open this future.
Yeah. Well, I'm not talking about some kind of creatures that you've never seen before. I'm talking about people like us who will be interested in grabbing a hold of some of these technologies in order to allow us to compete. One of the things that DARPA
Peter dominates
one or the other. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that DARPA is working on, for example, is creating the 7-day soldier. This is the soldier that can go for 7 days without sleep, without having any loss of cognitive function. What they're interested in is, for example, whales and dolphins don't sleep like we do. They can't. They're mammals. If they slept, they drown.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've learned to do is use different parts of their brain at a time while the other rests. Well, DARPA thinks that's a really cool idea. Not only would that have the potential of addressing Alzheimer's, but it would allow, you know, a soldier to run rings around people who actually do have to sleep.
They could fight for a week without fatigue.
Right. And think of what this will do to UPS. Think of what it'll do to Federal Express. Think of what it'll do to medical students who are, you know, doing their internships. This is not some kind of pie in the sky. The reason
you say will do, and we'll talk later about what's inevitable, but I notice you say will do. So there's the go for a week.
Yeah.
There's the strength as well, designing a kind of exoskeleton that the soldier steps steps into to become really superhuman in strength.
Yeah, I've jitterbugged in this suit, as a matter of fact. It's called, it's an exoskeleton. It's, think of it like a wearable robot. It's a it's like a suit that you step into, and it's got servo motors so that it senses your motion and it amplifies it so that 180 pounds feels to you like it's only 4 pounds. Mm. And this is in development at the University of California at Berkeley, and it's part of the Soldier program here at Natick Labs in affiliated with MIT.
So they could carry, you say, like a 300-350-pound backpack just as long as they need to. Then there's
forever.
There's a nourishment changes going on as well, or the way the body uses calories and food, fat.
Well, one of the things they look at is that special forces soldiers can easily go through 12,000 to 20,000 calories a day with their great exertion. And, you know, how do you feed somebody that much? You can't even carry that much food. Mm. So they're saying, wait a minute, maybe instead of sending them in lean and mean, we send them in mean and plump. And what DARPA is working on is amplifying the mitochondria in the cells so they could go and feed directly on the fat stored in your cells. When I finally realized that they were talking about allowing you to eat your fat, I raised my hand and said, me, give some to me. You know, I mean, I've been working out for how long, and I'm still...
Give me this now.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Talk about a diet program.
Right, and they kind of smile this little smile and say, the civilian implications of these technologies have not escaped us. Mm. You know, weight loss is a $40 billion a year industry in this country. This could change that.
But you're talking about people who are ultimately, as you say, almost seem like a successor version of the species by this century's end. And you do some... imagining about the social, just for starters, the social implications of that. I mean,
right.
Not everybody's in that crew. How do you imagine it spreading, first of all, mm-hmm. and who ends up where?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm not talking about the end of this century. I'm talking about in the lifetime of working people today. I'm talking that you'll be seeing this kind of effect in the next 10 or 15 years because of this curve of exponential change. You keep on seeing this doubling of change, and it means that the future is not some straight line. When you're on this kind of an exponential curve, the last 20 years is not a guide to the next 20 years. It's only a guide to the next 8. And the last 50 years...
Because you're going faster and faster.
Because you keep on doubling. Mm-hmm. And so the last 50 years is a guide to the next 14. I mean, I'm not talking about some kind of blue sky science fiction. And I'm not all that interested in the gear. I'm interested in how this affects our society.
Mm-hmm.
There are three scenarios that I talk about in Radical Evolution about how this might end up. One is the heaven scenario, and the poster boy for that is Ray Kurzweil, who believes that this technology is going straight up, and human history is going in lockstep with it.
Ray Kurzweil, interesting. The people, you've got the heaven scenario, the hell scenario. That's Ray Kurzweil, who's been our guest here. Mm-hmm. Bill Joy with the hell scenario, who's been our guest here. And then the prevail scenario, which you by a nose think maybe most likely Jaron Lanier, who authored the kind of notion of virtual reality, mm-hmm. who I've known for donkey's years. These guys kind of each speaking for one of these scenarios. But the heaven scenario, Ray Kurzweil's, is one where you have immortality and you live forever. He says he mm-hmm. intends to.
Yeah, that's right. Ray takes 250 pills a day, and he seriously does not plan on dying. Of course, whenever he says this, I can't help but start to write his obit mentally. You know,
but apologies, Ray. Good on you. You go, man. But he's not counting on vitamins and doing this. He wants to stick around long enough for that curve of technological development to give him the tools that you're foreseeing.
Yeah, Ray's position basically is that if you can live for the next 20 years, the technology will be so advanced as to effectively make you immortal because the technologies will be advancing faster than you're aging. And
so you replace parts as you need to, or you download your mind and move into another body, or I don't know what all.
Well, that's his version of it, mm-hmm. and that is a scenario. Now, mm-hmm. I don't say which of these is the most likely. I say that these are three very important visions of the future, and when you think about scenarios, what you should do is try to figure out some kind of a way to anticipate all three of them and figure out if there is a way of moving forward that's robust in all three, because the future is very likely going to be some combination of them.
Well, let's understand them better then. The heaven scenario. We understand that Ray Kurzweil wants to live forever and thinks he may very well do that.
Right.
That's his personal destiny, he would like to think. What does it mean for the... Is it heaven for the society, for the race, for the planet, if you have this kind of superhumans striding around?
Well, that's a really good question. One of the things that Ray is doing is that he is saying that our human history is technologically determined. I mean, if you were making a movie out of his heaven scenario, it would have great special effects, but not much in the way of plot. Mm. It would be everything's going to go great. There's not much you can do about it. Hang on tight. The end.
Here we go.
That's it. Great special effects. Great summer blockbuster. Not much of a plot.
Gee.
And the hell scenario is the mirror image of this.
This is Bill Joy's. You come into it with a quote from Albert Einstein, a letter to a friend, 1917. This is the hell scenario setup. He says, Albert Einstein, technological progress is like an axe in the hands of a pathological criminal. That would be us.
Could be. Yeah, well, in the hell scenario, what people point to is that, well, sure, this curve of technological change is increasing exponentially, but it could go out of control. Suppose it gets in the hands of criminals or even have accidents. There was the Australian mousepox incident, for example. In this case, Australia is apparently one of these ecologies where introduced species sometimes run amok and there's just mice everywhere. Mm-hmm. So they're keenly interested in controlling them. So they took a virus, mousepox, that does very bad things to mice, and they genetically altered it. And all of a sudden, they created a monster. They created a virus that was 100% fatal to the mice. Mm. Everyone died. Mm. And then they put it out on the web where everybody can see it. Well, mousepox doesn't hurt humans, but it's a very close cousin of smallpox, which obviously does. If you could create a 100% fatal smallpox that affects even the creatures that have been vaccinated against it, then you could end up in this hell scenario like the one that Bill Joy talks about, in which you eradicate the human species within 20 to 25 years.
So you spend a few years enhancing some human beings, but the technology that girds that ends up turning on you somehow. There's the gray goo scenario where these nanobots, these teensy tiny atomic level machines, just devour everything, turn it into soup.
Well, these nanobots offer a great numbers of promises. What these are robots that are much smaller than a human blood cell, and if you could pump millions of them into your bloodstream, they could go out and eat cancer cells, they could eat fat cells, they could just do dramatic things to increase your health, and there's every reason to think that this could be quite plausible in the very near future. Now, the problem is, if you start creating anything that can self-replicate, that can create more of each other, boy, you better know where the off switch is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, then these things can replicate faster than any mosquito. And at some point, the gray goo scenario is the one in which they create so many of themselves that they suck every piece of energy out of the entire planet. Mm. And it doesn't just wipe out all humans, but all of life on Earth. And within the very near future. That's the hell scenario.
This is the idea that Michael Crichton played with in a novel not so long
ago. In Prey.
And then there's the social implications of this. I mean, you say, look, this will affect everything. The law that we share today is based on the Enlightenment principle that we hold a human nature in common. What if we no longer hold a human nature in common in, as you say, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years? What if we've got two classes of human, then even those assumptions that go into the fundamental social organization begin to what? Break down?
What if all people are not created equal? I mean, this is Frank Fukuyama, who's a bioconservative, very much hates this idea of this kind of advance of technological change.
This Francis Fukuyama, the end of history guy.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And, he's got a real point. I'm glad somebody's bringing up the questions like this. But the question is, what do you do about it? And that's where these people who are advocates of the heaven and hell scenario, I think, begin to break down, because they see this curve of technological change as inevitable, which it probably is, but they then see the human history as being running in lockstep with it, and they're saying that there's nothing we can do to control this history, and that's where I hope they're wrong. That's where the prevail scenario comes in.
Hold that thought. I want to begin to turn to our callers. So many have been trying to get in. Jay's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Jay. You're on the air. What do you think, my friend?
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment. Earlier you spoke about the military technology patches that burn the fat for energy. Well, I'd actually like to say that I wear those every day, and they're amazing.
What kind of patch are you wearing, Jay?
They're called LifeWave patches. They're nanotechnology. And what they do is they send a signal to tell your body to burn fat as energy. And, the first time I put them on, I'm a runner. I could run about 10 miles or so, and, you know, I'd be beat. I put these patches on, and I ran a good 16, 17 miles, and I wasn't even really that tired.
Jay, where do you get them?
You can get them at RideTheLifeWave.com.
So this is a product you get there, and we hear it. And we hear in your readiness to use it, the kind of readiness to pick up technologies that Joel Garrow talks about. But Joel, you're shaking your head here in some skepticism.
The technology, I mean, I have no idea what this product is that he's talking about. But the stuff that's on the market right now doesn't really do anything that, I mean, if DARPA, if this existed, DARPA wouldn't be spending millions on it. What they're talking about doing is changing your cells at the level of the mitochondria, mm-hmm. which is tiny little portions that control, you know, how you get energy into the cell. They are working at a very deep level of cellular technology that it doesn't involve any kind of a patch, and it's nothing like anything that's on the market now.
But Jay, we appreciate your call. Jay is showing exactly what you're saying here, yeah. that an awful lot of human beings, when they perceive that there's a technology that's going to help them, that's going to enhance them, whatever risks may be involved to them personally or to the society generally, there's an impulse to dive in and grab that new technology.
Well, sure. I mean, can you imagine people who are enhanced lawyers, for example?
What do you mean? Just thinking faster, remembering more?
And never sleep.
And never – oh, the hours they could book.
168 hours a week.
Eric is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
Joel. I've been interested in the subject for the last 10 years. I read a book by Negroponte on nanotechnology, and it's kind of followed a certain path in my life. What I'm really concerned with, and I do agree with Joel as far as technology advancing to those levels and stuff, but there's also I think, an agenda at one point where we as a human collective society are seeing, getting exposed to the swan and other type of cultural aspects to kind of prepare us for this type of change.
The swan, did you say, Eric?
Yeah, that's a show where they change the features of women.
You mean on TV, the kind of reality show, yeah, where they come out all surgically enhanced and new teeth and everything.
Absolutely. And I think that right now in today's society that we are seeing those handset going and marketing, being marketed that idea that we could be better.
So what do you think about it? Where does it go? What does it make you consider?
Well, I think ultimately that someone's going to come up with a religion based on that, that they're going to create an ethereal heaven in the idea that you can actually download yourself into this ethereal nano world and never die. And I think that at some point, and I am a Christian, I believe that it's going to be the people that believe in that and the people that believe that humanity is for the sake of, you know, for doing God's work. And I think there's going to be a clash if it continues to go down that way.
All kinds of spiritual questions raised here. Eric, couldn't agree more, including, Joel, what is death? Yeah. I mean, if death is no longer, you know, it's not death and taxes anymore, but just taxes, as I read somewhere recently, I mean, you don't get much bigger spiritual provocations than that.
Well, this is one of the questions I ask, is what kind of a wisdom does it take to, you know, to face the idea of changing what it means to be human? I'm not particularly concerned about what happens 50 years down the road with changing religions. I'm worried about the here and now, what happens in the next 10 or 15 years. In the prevail scenario that I talked about, this is the one that holds that what's important is not how many transistors you can get to talk to each other. What matters is how many humans you can connect up. In the prevail is fundamentally unlike the heaven and hell scenario, mm-hmm. in that it thinks that humans can control their futures. Prevail believes that basically in human cussedness, that you can essentially take a page from the British during World War II, for example, who were not supposed to prevail against the Third Reich, but the nation of shopkeepers mm-hmm. did. Huckleberry Finn, back in that novel, was being told by everything in religion and society to do the right thing and turn in Jim, the runaway slave. and he finally decided at the pivotal moment that he was just bad to the bone, and he was not going to turn Jim in, and so the inevitable did not happen.
But what does prevail mean with this wave of technological development? We've got callers tonight who are ready to jump on the wave and prevail by mastering it and using it. Are you suggesting a resistance to technological change of humans themselves?
It could happen. I mean, these technologies, the GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech, provide so many advantages to the people who pick it up for military reasons, for economic reasons, for even aesthetic reasons, that I don't think that there's going to be any slowing down of these technologies. The question is, how do we shape our world? How do we shape our society in a fashion that it doesn't become some kind of a science fiction scare movie? In the prevailed scenario, the measure is how many humans you manage to connect up. So, for example, Jaron Lanier, who's one of the founders of virtual reality, who was the poster boy for this, says, well, what happens if you have a woman, for example, who manages to get a transplant of wings, and she shows up with wings? You know, is she supposed to, how are you supposed to handle that? Do you view her as insane, and do you reject her? Or do you say, well, you know, what she's trying to do is show you the contents of her mind on these wings.
You got my full attention. We've got to look at that after a break. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Washington Post reporter Joel Garrow, author of the best-selling book Edge City, Life on the New Frontier, and now his latest book, Radical Evolution, The Promise and Peril of Enhancing Our Minds, Our Bodies, and What It Means to Be Human. You can join the conversation tonight. You hear the kinds of technological enhancements Joel Garrow's writing about. He says they're already in the lab. They're being worked on right now. They will be reality soon if they're not already. What do you think? Will the rich be able to resist an upgrade? Will the poor be left behind? Does this sound like heaven to you, like hell? Will humanity prevail, and what will that mean? And how much can humans change and still be human? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Simon is calling from Rochester, New York. Hi, Simon. You're on the air.
Yeah, this to me sounds like a very old thing. In fact, I read about it, that we all have, I think, back in high school, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley.
Mm-hmm.
And this is much more peril than promise, because really, to begin with, the economic cleavages that we currently have are going to persist. That's not going to change, and it's those who have the money and therefore the ability to take advantage of these technologies that will. The others won't, by any means. That's the first point. And the second point is this whole idea of self-improvement, of self-enhancement, I mean, that's just very misleading, because really self-improvement, self-enhancement has to do with things that you can do without changing yourself through technology.
Simon, I know what you're saying. I know what you mean, but who says it has to do with things you do without technology? Is that just the way it was because that was the only alternative? Might that change here?
I mean, to take the example of this soldier who's got this exoskeleton or that makes him lift something that's 180 pounds, it feels like four.
Mm-hmm.
You take that exoskeleton away, he's the same person. You know, nothing has changed. You take that nanotechnology that's flowing the blood out, it's still the same individual. Self-improvement is something different. That person has exerted himself, has done a number of things to become a truly different person. Whereas this stuff doesn't really do that. It's technology there. The technology is gone. You're on a desert island. You're the same person you were before.
So you're saying this really isn't evolution. This is just kind of stuff tacked on to the core creature within.
Well, it doesn't really change the core creature. And what's worse is it perpetuates the current dichotomies, the cleavages that we have economically and socially. Those will become even more reinforced and re-entrenched, and that's the real danger.
Simon, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Joel Garrow, how about it? You call this radical evolution. Simon says, well, really? Are you really changing the creature within when the power goes down? Are we all just humans again, and maybe weaker than before?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the question is, you know, you look at the change from the Neanderthals to the behaviorally modern human. You know, what makes that difference? Well, the difference is the difference in cognition and in memory and in metabolism. Well, if you can change this in some kind of important way, you know, haven't you changed what it means to be human? Sure, if you turn off the electricity today, you know, we're going to have problems, but the cultural evolution that we've created so far, you know, in terms of cities and in terms of our ability to share our thoughts, that has fundamentally changed who we are over the last 8,000 years. We're not as cruel as we used to be. So I think that, sure, there was biological evolution. Then that moved to cultural evolution over the last 8,000 years as we shared our thoughts. Mm. Now we're moving into engineered evolution or radical evolution, and I think it's as big a kick as the one that got us out of the cavemen and into the kind of cities that we're in today.
But biological and cultural evolution are passed down through the generations.
Yes.
Here, you're talking technological enhancements that sound like you have to buy the Buick again in each generation,
yeah.
unless these are genetic, what do they call it, germline changes in your actual genome.
Yeah.
But that's not what I hear you describing in all these cases. So what is it? Is the evolution, as you describe it, depending every generation on being, as Joel says, loaded so you can buy all this stuff again?
Right. Well, I'm using a pretty standard definition of evolution, and that's one that confers advantage is inheritable and is a variation.
An exoskeleton is not inheritable.
Yeah, but that's thrown in because it's fun and because it already exists.
Well, okay, the Bluetooth chip in my head that helps me telecommunicate is not inheritable.
One of the things that the caller brought up was about, you know, what happens to poor people. Well, remember that this curve of technological evolution means that the price of this stuff keeps on dropping in half every 18 months. This technology is getting to the poor people in the third world much faster than previously.
You mean cell phones and...
You go to Nigeria, for example, as I did last year, and you're convinced driving around Lagos looking at the billboards that the cell phones are the third biggest part of the economy after religion and nutritional supplements.
Well, fine, but you write yourself. This is talking about the enhanced ones, looking down at what they dismiss as the rest. They say the poor dears, they just keep falling farther and farther behind.
That is a scenario. I'm not a Pollyanna about this. I'm not saying that it couldn't be terrible, but I'm saying that it's not the only scenario because these technologies are getting to the third world much faster than did refrigeration, radio, television, or automobiles. It is getting to the point where people in the Philippines can overthrow their government empowered by their cell phones as they did in the year 2000 because they could get hundreds of thousands of people on the street to protest the government.
That an old-fashioned radio that our beloved one. Matt's calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Sure. I'm just intrigued by this whole notion that somehow we could develop technology which would protect us from the arbitrary happenings of life, that ultimately you cannot predict and protect against the unpredictable. No one knows when cancer is going to strike a 35-year-old or you're going to walk out in the street and get hit by a bus.
Mm.
These things just happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's tragic that they do, but the level of complexity of the human body is far underappreciated. Look at simply Vioxx or Celebrex. No, certainly, you know, the companies didn't think these terrible things would happen to people's hearts, but then once they started marketing it to millions of people, they realized, there's something we didn't fully appreciate.
So watch out for serendipity, for even tragedy. No amount of enhancement relieves humans from those risks. We've got it, Matt, and thanks for your call. Joel, what do you say?
Well, we got to get rid of those buses. I agree with that.
Don't be hit by a bus.
Don't
be stronger than the bus.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, these technologies are advancing to the point where, I mean, one of the technologies that DARPA is working on is the ability to regrow arms that have been severed, for example, or a breast that's been removed in a mastectomy.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about generating very complex structures the way that salamanders can, for example, when their limbs are cut off. This is an ability that humans have had. If you cut off the tip of a finger of an infant, it will grow back.
But still, we're not utopians. Matt says it, and we know we've learned
that
every innovation brings its own new inherent kind of potential tragedy with it. You're surely not asking us to think that this won't as well. It makes us fear even magnified downsides because the upside is magnified.
Right. Well, the heaven scenario, the people who advocate the heaven scenario are convinced that this is all going to be peachy and that it's all going to be marching off into a golden future and that within 10 or 20 years we'll be in a place essentially indistinguishable from archangels. That is a scenario. I'm not advocating that one.
Let me get one more call here. Dana's calling from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. Hi, Dana. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi.
This to me sounds like a lot of technocratic arrogance that just enhances the... you'd call it the collective ego of our species.
Kind of ego trip for the species.
Yes, we already arrogate ourselves above the other animals and plants. We always tend to keep ourselves apart from them and above them, and this just sounds like more of the same. It's another utopian scheme, which may be real. I mean, the technology may be plausible in the future, but I really hope it doesn't amount to anything. I think our species needs to learn humility in the face of nature.
Got it. Dana, our time is short, but Joel Garrow, there's a call for humility instead of techno-supermen and women striding about.
Well, that is a good part of the prevail scenario, where we are talking about not being run by the technology, but being run by our own values. I don't really care about the gear that much. I care much more about culture and values, who we are, how we got that way.
But it's the changes in capacity that raise those new questions
about
the culture.
I mean, we are going to be facing these offerings in the next 5 or 10 years to conquer pain, to conquer being fat, to conquer sleepiness, to conquer forgetfulness, to conquer disease and suffering and death. The question is, what are we going to do about this in a fashion that allows us to keep our families intact and our culture and our societies intact? Those are the questions I'm asking in Radical Evolution.
You've got a deep dish serving of sort of surprising things here. Are you optimistic at the end of this or not, Joel?
Guardedly. I have a certain amount of faith in human cussedness. I think we have a way of throwing the curve a curve. I don't think the technology has to be in charge. I think that we can control our futures, but the first thing that we've got to do is understand that this curve of technology is coming at us in an accelerated way, and that's why I've been typing as fast as I can.
So you think you're going to live forever along with Brother Ray Kurzweil?
Every time I talk to Ray and he thinks he's going to live forever, I can't help but start to write his obit in my head. I'll believe it when I see it. I'm really worried about the next 20 years.
And the grandchildren of people listening tonight, will they recognize them? Will they see them with capacities they can barely comprehend?
Well, that's the question is, what does it mean to your family if your kids are greatly more capable mentally than you are? What does it mean, if you have a much longer and robust life than you expect? Suppose you're not going to go out at 80. Suppose that people who are alive today are going to make it to 100 and 150 with greatly enhanced capabilities like today's 35 or 40-year-old. I mean, are the people who are listening to this show right now ready for that kind of change? Because that's what's in the pipeline.
It's a lot to take on board, but you're giving us a big heads up. Joel Garrow, author of the new book, Radical Evolution, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation, dear listener, online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the Pentagon considers its own radical evolution. This is On Point. Senior Pentagon officials are considering a fundamental change in the way the U.S. military is structured, with the strain on American forces mounting because of the large number of forces needed in Iraq and Afghanistan. For decades, American military strategy has been premised on a capacity to wage two major wars at one time. But this may change. The Pentagon is debating whether the military should instead be prepared to mount just one war and devote more resources to anti-terrorism efforts and defending American territory. Tom Shanker is Pentagon correspondent for the New York Times and joins me now from Washington. Tom, you've reported on this today. How live is this debate?
Well, this is probably the central theme that's driving the debate right now in what's called the Quadrennial Defense Review. As that name indicates, it's done every 4 years, mandated by Congress, and this is when the Pentagon sort of steps back, takes a breath, casts its eye ahead, and what comes out of the review will determine the size of the military in years to come, as well as determine hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons purchases. And this is the major question on the table for the review right now.
Now, describe for us, because for decades we've been told that the capacity to fight two major wars at one time was a fundamental strategic necessity. Have I got that right? And have those circumstances changed?
No, that's exactly right. The theory was, for instance, during a war in Iraq, should another potential adversary, such as North Korea, attempt to take advantage of that commitment to Iraq, America needed to have sufficient forces to fight and win a second war. What planners are realizing that whether they actually could do that or not, and there's always been a bit of deterrence in the rhetoric of the two-war strategy,
right?
They're finally realizing it's time to have a strategy that fits the reality of the threat, the reality of America's capabilities, as much as anything else, the reality of the budget.
Now, the reality of the threat, though, could still be a two-war challenge, but you're saying the budget and circumstances no longer support that capacity?
That's exactly right. And if you look at sort of the possible peer competitors today with the demise of the Soviet Union, with Saddam Hussein gone, there are some who are arguing that while America should be able to fight and win one major conventional war, a lot of air and naval assets could hold a second adversary at bay in something short of what we think of as conventional war, and that would provide the necessary deterrence, because the real threats are the proliferation of unconventional weapons and the kind of irregular insurgent combat that we see on the ground in Iraq today.
Dom, describe, if you can, the constituencies for the old view and the new view. Is it a generational thing, or is it younger soldiers saying, enough with this two-war scenario, or is it more nuanced than that?
Well, as they said during the Watergate era, follow the money. And I think if you look at the advocates of the two-war strategy, the leading voices who want to maintain that is probably the Air Force. Because if they have to prepare for only one major combat operation, certainly they will not be able to get the money for the entire buy of their next-generation fighter as they want right now. I think the Army, too, would have to be reshaped drastically, probably putting a lot more money into lighter mobile forces, in particular special forces, and probably fewer of the kind of heavy armored brigades that you see now. The Marines are probably configured just about right, as is the Navy. So the Air Force and the Army, to my view, would be the two most affected by this kind of change.
And what might it mean on the ground? Let's say, heaven forbid, but let's say war or something close to it began to break out on the Korean Peninsula. Lots of very important strategic and economic assets around there. Japan, China, South Korea, real allies. Would it mean? Does it mean the U.S. just pulls out of Iraq and switches to the other front and leaves Iraq to fend for itself?
Well, it really couldn't, because there's no way to move the 138,000 troops in Iraq today in a timely fashion. The argument of those who say that we can have a one more strategy would say that because of advances in intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance, we would probably have greater warning of North Korean preparations for war. And if you look at sort of the map itself, any war on Korea today, as opposed to 30, 40, 50 years ago, would initially and heavily be an air power war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Air Force, and that's the Navy off of carriers. So really, this theory has a certain logic behind it, because any war in Korea would not be a major land battle. It would just be impossible today.
So do you see this, Tom, or do military analysts see this as simply smarter war fighting, smarter strategy, or a kind of maybe simply a diminishment of the level of U.S. military security?
What it really is, if they move to this strategy, and all your listeners should know that no decisions have been made,
mm-hmm.
and because of the rhetorical value of the two-war strategy to deterrence, at the end of the day, come February when the report's due, there may be no change. But if it does change, it's simply an attempt to have a strategy that better fits the real capabilities of the American military. It's not more, it's not less. It's just having a strategy that fits the force structure and vice versa.
But the old rhetoric may still be useful, even if we're at war, don't mess with us, because we say we have a two-war capacity. Of course, intelligence works for a lot of people. Others can figure that out as well. Tom, terrific reporting. Thanks for laying it out for us. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Tom Shanker, Pentagon correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Susanna Dillplane, Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Tim Skog, Angel Cazelli, Persephone Meal, and Cora Peterson. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.